The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. At least it is morning in rainy, wet, gray California, Northern California. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. It is our final program before Christmas. There is no Space Show program on Christmas, so let me take this moment to wish all of you out there a very Merry Christmas. For those of you that celebrate Hanukkah, it starts at the same time this year, and that's because of the way the moon works. And a very happy Hanukkah to you. And for those of you that don't celebrate holidays or celebrate something else, we wish you the best for however you choose to spend this holiday period. We have an interesting program for you today. Let me make the announcements and get right into talking to our guest, Chris Stone, who is back with us. Our toll-free number for those of you who would like to give us a call today, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, be patient, and we'll answer the phone and get you up on air just as quickly as possible. Remember, I will hold you over the break if applicable, or usually what we do is we just extend the break. And also, we do answer the phone during the break, so keep that in mind. You can use email to reach us, too, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you can post comments on our blog for this show. So if you go to our website, thespaceshow.com, and go to upcoming shows, and by the way, this is the only one listed because I need to fill in the rest of the show, then open it up and scroll down to the comment section and post away to your heart's desire, and I will be able to read your questions or comments on air. And that also, if you do go to our website, thespaceshow.com, we do have the detailed website newsletter there, and it will be uploaded Sunday after the Sunday Space Show program. And since there is no Sunday Space Show program because it is Christmas, I will still upload a fresh newsletter on the website sometime on Sunday. Note also that there is no program on Monday. I'm considering that to be part of the Christmas holiday period, and we resume Tuesday night with Open Lines show. So if you want to subscribe to the email version of the website, of the newsletter, not the website newsletter, it's very short, won't clutter up your email box. Please send me your email address, and we will add you to our list. The email newsletter goes out about 6 a.m. California time every Monday morning. We do have a store where you can get T-shirts and other things of that nature that say the Space Show on it. So go to the upper left menu and you'll see support. And the store for selling T-shirts, coffee mugs, other paraphernalia with the Space Show on it is under that support menu. So if you have a need for last-minute gift shopping for someone in your family who listens to and likes the Space Show, or somebody who is interested in space, keep us in mind, and we appreciate that very much. There is still time to support the Space Show. We are still in our annual fundraising drive for the Space Show, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and your gifts are tax deductible if you pay federal taxes, and the same if you pay California taxes. But we have to receive your gift by the end of the year in order for your you to be able to claim a deduction for 2016. So time is running short, but more important, your support keeps the Space Show on the air, keeps us going, keeps our content free of charge. Without your support, we simply will eventually disappear. So we really need your support, and we want your support, and we thank all of you who have supported us and who will support us before the end of the year. So again, you can click on PayPal on the homepage, or you can go to OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and there you can click on PayPal as well. If you don't want to use PayPal, then if you still click on the PayPal link, it will tell you how to send a check. Or you can see that also in the upper menu of the new website under support. And you do make checks payable to OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and you mail them to Post Office Box 95, Tiburon, T as in Tom, I, B as in boy, U-R-O-N, California 94920. We do thank you for your support and your contributions. And again, it's vital for the space show. So please do support us, and we appreciate that very much. One more week to go, just about, for 2016's annual fundraising campaign. And we have sponsors. Let me go first to podcasting. Many of you do think this is a podcasting show, but actually it's a live radio broadcast on the Internet. And we do archive our programs as MP3s and as podcasts. It is not a podcasting show per se. But if you do want to listen via podcast, you can do so on your smartphone or on your computer. And we are in iTunes and a host of other places on the net. So do check it out. If you have any problem, please let us hear from you, drspace@thespaceshow.com. The RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast is on our website, and both the website newsletter and the very short email newsletter I mentioned a few minutes ago. And as for sponsors, please check out their banner ads across the homepage. We just changed the banner ad for the space finance group, the space plan, and so go check it out. They're alternating between different ads, and in fact, as a sponsor, they do have their new banner ad up for this month, and their message is the Space Finance Group is a team of space advocates with crowdfunding experience. Members of our team have helped raise over $1 million through crowdfunding. We'd like to help you raise the funds you need to get your space project going. If your idea can be moved forward for under $250,000, crowdfunding can be an ideal solution. We're the only crowdfunding team that specializes in space projects. We understand space. We're the people behind the Integrated Space Plan, for example. And we understand the audience you need to reach. Visit us online at spacefinancegroup.com. And you can reach us at jwittner@spacefinancegroup.com. Remember, no buck, no buck Rogers. And the Space Foundation also is a sponsor. They have the 2017 must-attend space industry event, the 33rd Space Symposium, April 3rd through the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Their website, spacesymposium.org. And finally, for the first segment of our program, we are brought to you by Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And we're truly appreciative of our sponsors. By the way, we have a few more sponsor slots available for 2017. If you are interested in being a sponsor and having your message read on each space show program, as well as having your banner ad go across our homepage, contact me before the end of the year, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that brings me to our program today, and I'm very happy to bring back Chris Stone, who is a space policy and strategy professional in Washington, D.C. He has both a B.A., an M.A., well, I guess he has multiple degrees, and an M.S. He has provided expertise and analysis for over 11 years, supporting numerous government entities, such as the National Security Space Office, Air Force International Affairs, National Reconnaissance Office, and several interagency and industry government space councils with the principal DOD space advisor staff at the Pentagon. Chris began his space career when he entered the Air Force as a graduate of the University of Missouri. He has served in various roles and responsibilities to include staff member for two senators, executive director of a public-private Economic Partnership, and Space Policy Consultant in Washington, D.C. He has served as an ICBM Launch Officer, Mission Director for National Level Space Operations Center, Space Strategy Planner supporting U.S. Pacific Forces, and has led and developed international space engagement between key allies in Europe and the Asian Pacific. He is also very published, but I could keep reading about him for the entire first segment of the program. So rather than do that, please do read his full bio. It is uploaded and current on the Space Show website. And time to talk with Chris. Merry Christmas. Welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
About maybe 6 weeks ago, you turned me on to this CNN special, which is now about three weeks old, that was on DOD space and space defense and national space security. And it was really interesting from several perspectives. So first of all, it interviewed key people, and I assume the interviews are not fake news, that they're for real. It also took you behind the scenes in some of the classified and very secret space defense and security agencies and their control rooms. But it certainly painted, for people who aren't familiar in this field, a very scary picture that our adversaries, specifically China and Russia, can do a hell of a lot more damage to our commercial and national space assets and space economy than we're prepared to deal with. And we're not really prepared to deal with much of it, nor are we in a position to, you know, be that offensive to take care of business if they start messing with us. Is any of that true? Did they scare us with justification, or is it hype? How do you assess that CNN documentary? Which, by the way, listeners, you can see on YouTube. I forget the actual name of it, but in the archives of this show, I will put the YouTube URL on it if you do want to spend about 50 minutes and watch it.
Right. So I watched it when it came on, and I thought overall it was better than the 60 Minutes report that was from a few years ago. It was similar in some ways, but I think it was overall better in the sense that, as you mentioned, it gave a good sense of how integrated space is into our daily lives of the country, whether it be energy, power grids, whether it be banking systems, whether it be transportation, you know, and of course military forces. There, you know, space stuff up there and the ground infrastructure is very critical to the way we live and breathe and you know, live. So I thought that was a good thing to show how a potential scenario could go down, and how fast it could spread, especially dealing with GPS and satellite communication. When you mentioned the scare part, the interviews were fine. I like these interviews better than the 60 Minutes interviews. I think they're a little more substantial in many ways. But at the same time, I think it was a little sensationalistic in some areas, and there were some errors in my view. But overall, the scenario was good. I think it painted a realistic picture of the infrastructure risk and our vulnerabilities there.
One comes away thinking that we are really at risk with both our commercial space assets as well as our government space assets. And of course, they made the point, but I don't think they made the point as strongly as they need to make it for the general population, although we've talked about it a lot on the space show, is that we are so dependent upon space for our economy. Even buying gas at the corner gas station with a credit card relies on timing mechanisms with GPS. That if we got blinded, we're not talking about losing capabilities for smart weapons, for example. We're talking about taking down major segments of our economy for major periods of time. Are we prepared to face that kind of a threat, or Do we have our hands in our pockets? I mean, what is our status in being able to protect our assets that are in space, both for our economy as well as for the national security of the country?
Well, in my view, I think this is part of where the error in the program lie. Not in that they had good scenarios, not that this stuff couldn't possibly happen, but that I think one of the guys made it seem like that the U.S. was on a quote-unquote war footing because of the threat to our infrastructure and that we've been doing a lot of stuff. I'm only aware that of a few studies that I referenced in my book on space deterrence regarding GPS. A lot of them, I know that the UK also has a government report based on their concerns with GPS-specific interdependencies. And there has been discussions about whether or not we need to be less dependent on it or regress from using space as much and basically become less space-faring, if you will, in that respect. I personally don't think we're as prepared as this show made us out to be. I personally think that while we have folks monitoring things, the article that went with the CNN report, I think, was a little more accurate when it says that pretty much all they have the ability to do now is watch. So the people in the JSPOC or the JICSPOC or whichever op center that they talk about, which I think they mentioned both of those, they pretty much just have the ability to watch. And we've been investing in a lot of ways to have space situational awareness, and whether it be high orbit and geo with that GSAP thing that General Shelton mentioned about a few years ago, as well as ground tracking stations. So we don't really have the ability to actively defend against attacks, especially kinetic attacks. Reversible attacks, against some things, we have some passive means that have been discussed on the show and elsewhere. But the way the show made it look like we had laser cannons and missile systems that were ready to go, that wasn't quite the case. Both of those programs were created for different means, and yes, they could be adapted for that, but, I haven't seen any evidence to indicate that there's any active programmatics to deploy them actively in case of a potential, disaster.
Is this likely to change? Is our policy likely to be something different under the Trump administration, or is this something where we are technologically at a point where we don't really have a choice short of a lot of new technology investment and development?
Well, the reason I wrote a recent article in Space News Magazine was on this critical space infrastructure vulnerability, and I wrote it as an op-ed to the incoming administration because I think there's a possibility that we might see something, I'm hoping at least, because of Trump's emphasis on infrastructure rebuilding and rebuilding national defense. This issue for our vulnerability of critical space infrastructure crosses both of those areas of interest. And based on what little has been written in op-eds and things that we can legitimately claim as good information, not the speculation articles that are all over the place, but the ones from legit advisors seem to indicate that they plan on taking this a lot more seriously than we may have seen in the last 8 to 10 years. So I'm hopeful, but until we really see who their advisors end up being for national security space specifically and space broadly, it's just kind of a speculative exercise.
Does the proposed DOD guy, General Mattox, coming from the Marine Corps, mean anything in terms of space readiness? The Marine Corps is not really one of the organizations that focuses on space per se.
Well, basically on what I know about General Mattis, he's a very aggressive, hard-charging guy. He served 40-some years in the Marine Corps. He's a strategic thinker. I've seen memos from him about, word usages and comments and strategic terms and things that may sound like semantics to the person outside the department, but when it comes to policymaking, words mean things, and the fact that he takes the time to think things through gives me some hope that he'll be good. I haven't really seen much writing of his or commentary of his as a Marine general, at least on space systems. He may view it just as a nice to have and not necessarily required for Department of Defense, but I'm sure that when he's getting ready for his confirmation hearing that the offices that have relevant space equity, such as OSD policy, for example, will definitely do what they can given the Senate's interest, specifically Senator McCain's interest in counter space threats and things of that sort. So we shall see, but I think there's more possibility for positives with General Mattis based on what I know.
Do our adversaries have the weapon systems ready to go and deployed that the CNN special seemed to indicate were already deployed and ready to go?
Yeah, the program used terms like massive amounts and things of that sort. What I've known from open source material that I use in my book and articles are mostly focused on their testing of kinetic interceptors. They do have those. They have been testing them. The Russians are jumping back on that testing bandwagon, and have been deploying, assets. And of course, over the last decade or so, even longer, there's been reports in the news and even in open source congressional hearings from NRO directors and other people that lasers have been used on our systems. But with aggressive behavior occurring terrestrially, like South China Sea and in Eastern Europe, space becoming a very large portion of their counterintervention or hybrid war doctrines, I think that definitely you're going to see a lot more deployments and you're going to see a lot more potential uses, especially given that reversible means, jamming, spoofing, things of that sort, have become sort of the norm behavior. In fact, I think there was a Space News report maybe a year or so ago that referenced the tripling of reversible jamming, purposeful interference, occurring on commercial assets as well as government assets in the last 8 or so years, I believe was the number they used. So this is not a future tense problem. This is a current problem that, barring a change in state understandings of how important space is, which I doubt, then this is only going to get worse if we don't take some action.
You have an email from Abby, who is in Denver, Colorado. And Abby says, typically when space is talked about, it is broken down into national security or defense, civil, which is NASA, and then commercial, which is the private sector. It would seem to me that all of the other sectors are dependent upon two things. One is the goodwill of our adversaries not to bother us, and maybe it's not as much goodwill as it is fear of retaliation. And two, that we are able to provide a stable market for these other resources in space to operate, similar to the way the U.S. Navy provides freedom of navigation around the oceans, of course, with help from other freedom-loving navies as well. But that was always a mission of the Navy, was to provide freedom of passage and clear passage for everybody around the oceans. So if, in fact, commercial space and NASA rely on sort of a free passage in space doctrine similar to the oceans, then is the National Security Space Divisions of our country up to the task, as is the Navy, with providing free passage on the oceans?
That's a very good question, with a lot of meat to it. So let me try to break it down a little bit. So starting with the last part, using the Navy analogy in the high seas and the freedom of navigation, there is, of course, the freedom of overflight norm, as it's considered, that goes back to Sputnik, that pretty much anybody has the ability to have freedom of overflight over any landmass because they're in space, and space, therefore, is free for all to use per treaty. However, are we up to the task currently? I would say no, because we have conducted what some authors have referred to as strategic restraint, or basically a deterrence through non-deterrent means. So we've redefined some terms that makes it sound strong, when in reality we really don't have the capacity to defend ourselves again or our commercial interests against kinetics specifically, and in some cases not as well as we probably could be on the reversible side. So as a result of that, going back to your earlier question, about the Trump administration. That's one good thing that I have seen, if it happens, is the proposal for a National Space Council again, and this one being meant to unify the policy and planning and security needs for all three sectors, commercial, civil, and national security intelligence. So I think there's some chance to fix things and to move in a direction more like the way the Navy operates on the seas and provides freedom of navigation and helps preserve that. But for a while, we haven't really been viewing it as a similar operating domain. We viewed it as a sanctuary, which a lot of folks, including myself, never really understood why or how that could be possible, given the activities and the reliance on of that domain on many countries. So, and then finally, you mentioned that with the goodwill piece and the fear of retaliation if we were attacked in space, there is a common thought that there was a tacit approval between the Russians and the United States in the Cold War that if any of our assets were attacked, that would mean nuclear escalation. And based on current administration's policies, overtly telling people what we won't do in circumstances, that's kind of negated in many of our allies' minds, like the French and the Japanese, that we don't really have the political will to retaliate, especially not for a satellite, because there's no lives involved, they think, and therefore, what's the point? But as that program mentioned, and as I mentioned in some of my writings, that it's not just about nuts and bolts that support the military or NASA exploration anymore. It's about being linked into an infrastructure that ties into everything from entertainment to how we bank transactions. So I don't think they really have a fear of retaliation. In fact, the Chinese doctrine and Russian doctrine view offense as the key. They view that the best way to deter an adversary, including us, is to attack, to prevent us from attacking, even though we don't have a means to, or at least to keep us out of their hair so they can do what they need to do on Earth, or slow us down. And then the Chinese view space attacks as what they label as low threshold. So even if they did strike a satellite or two that blinded us or took us offline for a little while or whatever, they view that as something that we wouldn't be willing to escalate over, that it wouldn't be that big of a deal. It'd be politically tough and psychologically challenging for our leadership to do so. So we shall see if the National Space Council, as the Trump administration has discussed barely in the press, if that really fixes this. But I don't think we're prepared right now, and I think we have quite a ways to go.
Should the normal viewer of that CNN show be concerned? I mean, it seemed to reach the normal viewer, and I don't know if wake up is the right word, but you know, it might have made them think or be a little afraid. I mean, it made it sound like China could knock out our satellites at any time, and we couldn't do much about it. Russia, so-so, and that we've been sitting on the sidelines, and it wouldn't just be an inconvenience. It would be a serious takedown of the economy with a long, long time to recover. And they specifically talked about how responsive space ideas had not gelled. So there isn't the ability to rapidly replace a taken out satellite.
Right. Yeah, I would say that was accurate in the sense that we don't have the ability to strike in the same kinetic means as other countries are working towards. And we, for example, yes, we shot down one of our own satellites back in 08 or so using a modified Standard Missile 3 off of an Aegis destroyer. But that's not something that's prepared and ready to go right now. That's something that took months to modify, and we knew we had time to deal with that hydrazine issue and the reentry and all that good stuff. But when you look at the Chinese testing of their ASAT weapons, the kinetic side, and their behavior with just ocean going and airplanes and building islands with the missiles on them, it's not really unlikely to see them use what they view as a low threshold weapon system, even if it creates debris and a whole lot of consternation among folks who are more environmentally conscious than other countries might be. There is abilities. They have demonstrated abilities to go as far high as GEO, which is 22 some thousand miles, all the way down to low Earth orbit. So So in that case, yeah, they can hit kinetically anything that moves up there with kinetic interceptors, and with all the other open source discussions and congressional hearings and reports on readiness of various countries that the DOD and other think tanks put out. I think that is something that we should be concerned with, and I think we should be talking to our representatives about more. And I will say lastly that about the representatives, the Congress seems to be getting it. The last few National Defense Authorization Acts seem to be pointing to their understanding of the need for a more offensive dominant approach given the way the current domain is, and a need for a more credible deterrent posture. I think I mentioned to you once before in a private discussion that Senator McCain, during General Hyten's confirmation hearing for his new job as U.S. Strategic Command commander, that he was concerned by what he was hearing about what the Russians and Chinese were doing, and specifically as a means to go after us if they felt like it. And he asked General Hyten, what are we doing to have something similar capacity to hold their stuff at risk? And General Hyten's response was, we're not going down that path. And that path meaning we're not currently developing any means or capacity to hold other nations' critical space infrastructure at risk the way they are with us. And so I didn't gather from the transcript that I read, just to make sure that the news article I read was being accurate. It was. I'm not quite sure that they got the answer they were looking for unless it was in a closed session. So I'm a little concerned, and I would definitely want to write my representatives to say that this is an issue that needs to be addressed.
What would you say to the representative? Beef up national space security? Create kinetic weapons? I mean, what would you be saying to them?
Well, like in my commentary, I mentioned that it's a kind of a mixture of things. In the near term, there are some things we can do, and over the long term, we have to start looking at things differently. First, we need to look at the current situation as what it is and not what we want it to be. The current administration's national security strategy, the first one, not the current one, you had a section called The World as We'd Like It to Be. And then you had the National Security Space Strategy, which is a subset of that, and the space policy to talk about shaping the future. And that's great, but they seem to just consider that the more you have a norm development where you go among the allies and other countries and try to get everybody to agree that something is bad or not bad. And then you do all this other stuff. Well, that's great too, but if you have nothing to enforce that with, then you're just trying to rely on paper and goodwill, like the previous question said. So I think we need to realize that we are in an offensive dominant domain. There are adversaries out there, whether they are current or potential, that are developing weapons, and their doctrine clearly states why they're developing them as an asymmetric advantage over us, and the ability to gain their terrestrial threshold advantage wherever they need to. And once we get that figured out, then we can start looking at how we organize, train, and equip our space groups to be ready. And I personally do not believe that, as the Space Mission Force white paper states, that, you know, enhanced training of operators is a deterrent. I don't buy that. A deterrent requires something that gets into the mind of the adversary. It's tailored to that adversary, and it gives them something that makes them think, do I really want to do this? And basically, just making yourself more resilient is not going to cut it, because they can, you know, get limited damage doesn't mean they want to destroy everything. They may want to just take something offline, limited time, and then achieve an objective to slow down our response. So that's one thing. The other thing is on the kinetic side, which is sort of one area we haven't really done a whole lot into, by our own self-restraint, is there's a concept called first strike stability, and right now we don't have that. First strike stability, as I mentioned before, is where each side of a two-party construct, whether it be us and the Russians or us and the Chinese or whoever, if one side has the ability to conduct a first strike and we don't, then that's an instability. And currently that's where we are. We're in a situation where a couple different countries are testing and fielding kinetic interceptor potentially, our potentiality capabilities, and we don't have that. We don't even have an R&D program really for that. We had some that could have been modified, such as the DARPA ALASA, which was kind of looks like a celestial eagle ASAT tester from the 80s that was re-jerry-rigged into being a small sat responsive space thing that got canceled. You could modify the SM3 like we demonstrated we could do before, but actually deploy so many ships with so many of these types of vehicles on board that, and then put them on seafaring vessels where the geometry was such that if there was an ASAT attack launched from China or Europe, that they were in position for patrol to take them out. So there are means to get some of that, but long term, it's going to take a while to get us to get off what people term as the Battlestar Galacticas that have no real heavy shielding, don't really have a lot of ways to shoot back, don't have active defenses, and I think we need to get there. So those are just a few items. There's a lot more, but I have those just off the top of my head.
So I've got more emails from you from listeners, but first I want to throw something at you because not everybody shares your views, and there are documents out there and people that have really good reputations. You and I talked about them on the telephone, they are advising the administration. I don't know if they're advising the Trump administration or not, but their point of view, their perspective, especially about China, for example, is close to 180 degrees from you, and I have people constantly sending me emails about no weapons in space, and the top generals don't want any weapons in space, and we've got to guard against any kind of weapons, including anti-satellite weapons in space, and we can reduce the tensions through active in diplomacy and some of these policies that you and I have talked about that have appeared by others in different papers. So the other view seems to be prevailing right now, and maybe that's because of the Obama administration is more akin to it than they are to what you've been talking about. But if it's this way or that way, I mean, choose one or choose the other, how do you know what the right one is to choose? I mean, there does seem to be some advantages that others have over us because of the kind of policy we have accepted and participated in, but nothing bad has happened as a result of all of this, and we are, so to speak, I guess, at peace. So how do we know that, you know, developing kinetic weapons or doing some of the things you're talking about won't spark trouble, whereas what we've been doing seems to maybe be working?
Yeah, well, the problem is with people like that, is that a lot of times the folks on that side of the discussion believe that the problem is the United States and we have all this vast capability and our objective is to dominate and seize the control of space. And our policy has not been that for quite a while. Because frankly, there hasn't been a lot of support in Congress and from going back to the 70s and 80s. And also folks on the side tend to say that we always go for the military option approach, which is also not the case because we have not done any military options in space other than using space assets as utility for terrestrial operations. So a lot of the viewpoints on the other side about strategic restraint, and if we don't do anything, others won't do anything, it's all because of what we're doing, is just plain false, and it's not reality. Just is not. I mean, you can't open up space news without seeing something over the last year or two about the tripling of reversible purposeful interference on satellites, whether commercial or otherwise. You have testing of anti-satellite weapons by not our country, but by two other countries that have a mixed relationship history with us. And some would say adversarial relationships with us. And if this was a time where there was nobody testing anything and there was no tripling or reversible jamming and there was no, nations invading other countries and setting up islands and seizing control of places on the seas, then I would say, sure, you know, let's give it a shot. Let's give strategic restraint a shot and see if they follow our lead. But that doesn't seem to be what's going on. And like I said, it's not a quiet, peaceful place up there. There are things going on. that have been reported on in the press on the reversible side. So I would say that the new norm is not compliance and peace and calm and happiness and tranquility. I would say that the new norm is purposeful interference on a reversible side with kinetic use up to the testing scale of things. And if we wait until adversaries start building a ton of these capabilities, while we still sit back and think that people are not going to do anything if we don't do anything to them, which is not true, and that has never been the case historically, then we're setting ourselves up for a very, very bad day, a day that the Chinese themselves refer to as a grave aftermath, and the Rumsfeld Commission back in 2001 called a space Pearl Harbor-like event. So while some people think this is all, you know, spinning people up for nothing, from my experience over 13 years of working in real-world operations and policy sphere, I just disagree with that, and that's why I've written against some of these viewpoints, because for whatever reason they just don't see what's happening as it being because of other nation states' actions. They view it as weapons are bad or arms control, or it'll be damaging to the environment, which I agree with. But if they're going to attack our stuff and we have no means to prevent that or counterstrike, because space is hard to defend, it takes time to get your systems designed for that because they haven't been designed for that. So I would disagree with that, and I would say that there is a way to mix both. There's a way to continue the diplomacy. I'm not against diplomacy. That's fine. But you have to have something to back it up with, and you can't just back it up with a sheet of paper with a glossy cover on it and call it a deterrent. You have to have a, no kidding, something that will get in their minds and the heads and the strategic cultural thinking of your potential adversaries. Say, we know why you're doing this. This is not fruitful to you. And oh, by the way, saying that we're willing to absorb it and fight through it, as the term goes, or even use the phrase that we're currently operating in a contested, degraded, and operation-limited environment, is basically saying to your adversaries, all the stuff you're doing to us is working, and we're willing to accept it. That's not a deterrent strategic communication framework.
Have you...
And it's not so good, yeah.
I was going to ask if you've ever had an opportunity to engage in a debate with people representing the status quo from today or other perspectives in yours, and what happens when you do engage in that debate.
The only kind of debate that I've had, the closest thing to a debate, was the Space News editorial page, where on one side was me being critical of the Atlantic Council report that came out this past summer, and the writers of that report who wrote a counterpiece on the other side of the page. Other than that, it's mostly just been a back and forth in journals and online space reviews and things of that sort. I haven't had any verbal debates, though.
What happened with the he said, she said in Space News, is there a winner based on comments or anything like that?
I didn't see a whole lot of commentary on the website, because this was in the paper edition.
Uh-huh.
On the Space Review version of my critique, there was a lot of support, and obviously there were some not happy people, but a lot of the people seemed to understand that. I will say, from some of my contacts and friends and colleagues in the Washington, D.C. area, even some on the Democratic side of the equation, I think since 2014, since the GEO test, even some folks on the Democrat side are leaning more toward that, yeah, maybe this isn't working so well. And they even agree with my assessment of Atlantic Council that there really wasn't anything new in that report. It was just rephrasing current NSSS and current Obama policy viewpoints, some of which they agree, they think that hasn't been employed correctly or well enough. And that may be true, but if it was more well executed, it would be worse. So I'm kind of glad in a way that there were people in the Congress and there were people in even the civil service that, you know, did their due diligence to try to make it at least somewhat useful.
For those that may want to read the Atlantic Council and see what you're talking about, do you know the actual name of the report and how we can find it?
Oh, shoot. I don't remember the exact title, but it, if you go to the, if you Google search Atlantic Council National Security Space Strategy, it should pop up. It's talking about a new National Security Space Strategy for the future or something to that effect, and it has a cover sheet that looks like Starry Night from Van Gogh. But, and that's it. I think if you Google search that, or you go to spacenewsmag.com, and you do a search for, under commentary for Atlantic Council, it should pop up and you should be able to see both sides, and they link to the report in that website.
Okay, I'll, listeners, I'll see if I can put that in the archives so that, you can get the other perspective and you can, make some of your own decisions rather than just rely on one way that we're talking about on the show, this or that, or one way or the other. You do have an email, and then we'll go take a break, from Veronica, who is in Phoenix. Chris, would you please elaborate on the strategy of transparency and how the DOD's posture is currently and in the foreseeable future? As you have mentioned before, it is to enhance global power cooperation. However, the space deterrence framework is based on transparency, and how does this affect adaptability and unpredictability of certain countries who are moving forward with their space endeavors, not with exploration or sustainability for a global benefit, but for military gain? So, Chris, when you answer that, which I hope you will answer, a lot of people may not know what Veronica is really talking about. So perhaps you can answer it with a little bit of background to help listeners who don't follow the nitty-gritty of space deterrence and space national security.
Sure. So transparency, what she's referring to, is that it's one of the main tenets of the current policy and the current National Security Space Strategy is what's called Transparency and Competence Building Measures, or TCBMs. And what the idea is that if we as a country are transparent with our intents, our intentions, our goals, our objectives, that we have no, that we mean them no harm, and that space is open for everybody, and that's it, then another country that thinks that we're threatening them in a space-related whatever should go, oh, okay, we see that, we understand what you're saying, and we're not, we're gonna back off that and join in the discussion in a more productive manner. The problem with that approach is, again, not terrible for every country you deal with, but for some countries who have unique worldviews, view transparency as a problem, not as a benefit. So they don't view it as a good thing. They view it as a part of deception. And obviously, the Chinese, being one of the countries I find the most fascinating, they're one that specifically views that, going back centuries. They view transparency that we're conducting as a sort of a false deception, and that basically it's a sign of weakness for us to ask them to open up all of what they have and what their intentions are, because if they are a weaker country, militarily than we are, their traditional doctrine is that if you're going to have any possibility of having victory over a stronger opponent, going back to Sun Tzu and other writings, that you need to keep your good stuff close at hold and only demonstrate it as an act of deterrence against your stronger opponent. So that's why I'm kind of critical of transparency alone as a means to security. It's not, it doesn't really seem to be all that effective, especially given the fact that all of our transparency efforts have seemed to be not reciprocating. So we send guys over to China, whether it be the NASA administrator or whether it be a military-to-military talk, and the tours they give per open-source reporting is not exactly eye-watering. So while we're opening up command centers and things of that sort to these folks saying, see, we only have this kind of stuff, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I'm not really a big proponent of transparency. Again, you have to tailor your deterrent policies toward your adversaries, and treating everybody the same, while it may be good from a Western perspective, from some Asian perspectives, that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to them.
So, Okay, so Len, Veronica has another question, and then we'll take a break. I'll get her other one in here too. Where is it? Got to pull it up. Okay. Do you foresee the private sector in assisting DoD in increasing a safe domain for legitimate users related to the framework of space, and if so, how?
Yeah. I worked quite a bit with industry and the commercial sector when I was still working actively in D.C. in the Pentagon. And I will tell you that they are very interested in helping create the resiliency, as people normally would talk about it, in the sense that you want to have multiple means of communication, you want to have multiple means of monitoring things without necessarily having to do it all through government-owned, designed, and launched capabilities. At the same time, that creates an even bigger burden on the government to provide for the defense of these assets. And in many cases, such as situational awareness and traffic management, we've been holding up things as best we can with where our limited resources are, but the industry has been picking up the slack on keeping track of where things are and making sure people don't crash into each other unintentionally. When it comes to the intentional part, there really hasn't been a whole lot of clear-cut policies or strategies that I've seen that indicate how this would all work out. I am a little leery of relying a whole lot more on them, because you still want to have backups. You don't want to say we're just going to buy our services and make it more vulnerable. That makes about as much sense as the other proposal that was big about 3 or 4 years ago about bringing in all the allies and the purchasing pieces of our new constellations going up, whether it be a SATCOM, you know, bird or a whatever, that if someone attacks that satellite constellation, they're attacking more than one country. And that's true. They would be attacking more than one country. But the problem is there's no agreements with those purchasing agreements that indicate any use of force or any threat to use force if attacked upon. The only thing that we see is phrases like we reserve the right to act in self-defense, but not necessarily from space, sometime at a time of our own choosing, which is a very wide gap. And obviously, it's understandable you don't want to put yourself in a corner that you restrict your options. But at the same time, if you want to have a credible declaratory policy for deterrence, you don't want to say nothing and say, yeah, we could, but we're not really sure where, and we're not going to tell you where, and all that kind of stuff. So that's, to me, that's not the good form of uncertainty. That's the bad form of uncertainty.
Okay, listeners, we're going to take our break at the midway point. We're a little behind on that. And we'll be back with more of your comments and questions in a couple of minutes. And for those of you that do want to give us a call, and hopefully some of you have access to your phones, you're not all at work, it is 1-866-687-7223. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Friday program with Chris Stone. We're talking about national security, space, and related topics. We do have a couple of sponsors for this segment as well. AIAA is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They have five annual forums, which are like conferences or events: SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion, and Energy, and then Space. And they bring together like-minded aerospace pros across industry, academia, and government for a blend of engaging plenary sessions, in-depth Forum 360 programs, and robust technical programming and networking opportunities that jumpstart dialogues, discoveries, collaborations, and careers. Their members help make the world safer, more connected, more accessible, and more prosperous, and you can get a lot more information and join them by going to AIAA.org. And Celestis is a sponsor, and they are the global leader providing Memorial spaceflight services since 1995. I mean, that goes back a long time. And Celestis is also the only company on the planet to have successfully conducted Memorial spaceflight missions. And visit them at memorialspaceflights.com. That's a better website than the one I've been giving out, but they all go to the same place. And you can get a lot more information or to arrange your own Memorial spaceflight for yourself or a loved one. And again, that is memorialspaceflights.com. And there are reservations available if you do have someone you want to memorialize and pay tribute to on the upcoming flight at Cape Kennedy, or Cape Canaveral, I should say, and also in New Mexico at Spaceport America. And we thank our sponsors. Read their banner ads from time to time. Click on their websites and check out their services. So, Chris, how do things shape up now? We don't know who's going to be the NASA administrator, but we have this landing team for space, and I haven't seen as much about national security space or something like that in terms of landing team. But what we mostly hear from Wall Street Journal writers and others is that there's sort of this infight brewing between what they call legacy or traditional aerospace versus new space or commercial space. We don't hear much about the landing team in national security space. What are you able to infer what our policy might be? There will eventually be a new national space policy. And again, what mostly we hear on the Space Show is on the issues like space settlement and things of that nature, not referring back to what we're talking about today. Your insights, please.
Sure. So there's a lot of articles going around speculating about NASA specifically. Not a whole lot, like you said, on the national security space side of things. However, there are a lot of speculating articles I've seen that are kind of frustrating to me, that try to blend the two together in a sense, like there are some headlines out there that saying that, you know, the new NASA advisor, which is not a NASA advisor, it's a landing team lead, Chris Shank, is going to militarize space through NASA, which makes no sense whatsoever. Then there's other headlines that say stuff like NASA is going to hobble through a Trump presidency. And there are some good ones, like Wall Street Journal, you mentioned, had one talking about Senator Sessions, who's now apparently tapped for Attorney General, that because of his state, he's from Alabama, a pretty big space state, with ULA and Decatur and Marshall Space Flight Center working on space launch system and other big rocket stuff, that he has some influence. But if you look at the landing team makeup for NASA, you see, I think, a group of guys who are pretty well balanced between the so-called traditional aerospace and the new space. You have guys like Charles Miller, who I've worked with. He's a really great guy, does lessons on commercial space business, things of that sort, big with nanoracks and all that. You have Rod Liefeld, retired NASA policy guy I've worked with directly. He's a good guy. He's probably been around the government space, both military and NASA, for several decades. Chris Schenck, the guy that was mentioned to lead the NASA transition team, who's worked for Congress as well as the executive branch in NASA, and he has an Air Force background in some cases, too. That to me shows a little bit of that hope I mentioned for that National Space Council becoming a reality, because if you have a group of folks that can have a bigger picture and are willing to bring folks to the table that have experiences in both commercial sector and industry and government, that's what you want. You want those guys. You don't want it to be one or the other, because you want to synthesize the strengths of all the sectors. And that's what their stated goal of this council would be, is to bring all that together. I think you'll see a continuation of commercial space becoming more of a reality than it currently is. Currently, it's more of a public-private partnership with NASA, but as Bigelow tests their inflatables and things become more privately owned and operated, then I think you'll see a lot more use of that for low orbit. And I think the comments you hear from Bob Walker, that he's been giving some speeches to Comstock and things, also indicate that that's also going to be the case, that commercial and government space will be working together. It won't be one or the other. And I think that's good. The one thing I will mention about some of these speculation articles is a lot of them are reading things into things that they really shouldn't be. Just because a guy has an Air Force background doesn't mean that their goal is to militarize, which is kind of a weird term. I think what he was meaning was weaponize. But that doesn't really work. The same thing happened when a military officer, retired general in Canada, took over Canadian Space Agency. There was articles in Canada about, what is this going to mean for the civil space sector? Are they going to militarize the civil space sector? It's a false argument. I don't see it as a problem. And then finally, I will mention that having Mr. Thiel and other guys on the transition team is wise. But I will say there is a false narrative that if you want to discuss later on, we can, about people seem to have this notion that the Bush administration was all big government, as I've seen it, and not commercial, and that Obama was all about the commercial and not about the big government, which neither of those descriptions fits what happened. So I blog against that a few times, and I've written an article about the development of commercial crew and cargo for the Space Review several years ago, but I think it's interesting, all the speculation, and some of it's helpful, and a lot of it's just kind of inflammatory, because we don't have all the answers yet, but what I see looks promising.
Is there anything you've seen that our adversaries would construe as inflammatory?
Our adversaries would see? No, I think some of the articles that I've seen, the adversaries would find to be good, because it makes it look like that we don't have our act together, and that people are going to be arguing and squabbling, and there's not going to be any plan, and then nothing will get done under a Trump administration, which I don't see how that could be a reality based on everything I've seen and heard, either in press releases as well as in public statements, and just day-to-day work. So there are plenty of folks that work in the commercial sector, the civil sector, and the national security space sector that want to see America do great stuff. And I think that we're not going to see, I do not believe this, and if I'm wrong, then it'll be shocking to me, but I don't think we're going to see what happened in 2009 and 2010 with the wholesale cancellation of numerous space programs on the NASA and the DoD side. I think you'll see some cancellations. You may see some tweakings. But I think what most people are going to want to do is just take what we've been developing and build off of that. And with comments like they want to see the human exploration of the solar system by the end of the 21st century become a reality, I think that's a good comment. Whether or not we are able to get the funding and the commercial sector partnerships necessary to do that, I'm not sure. We'll have to see what happens, but I think that's promising rather than some of the other statements you saw from the other campaign that seemed to be more status quo.
You have a note from Harry in New Orleans, and he says, what do you gather from this team who may make up space policy on the U.S. wanting to go the route of international partnerships in costly space projects?
If I understand the question, you're talking about partnerships as a means to do space exploration partnerships.
Probably, yeah, so, I guess so. That he didn't specify, but I think so.
Okay. Well, if that's what you're asking, I don't see us. That's another thing. I don't see us retrenching from our partners. I don't see us doing what the current administration seems to have wanted to do, and that is let them lead, and we will just help. In some cases, there is an international group that works on the global space exploration plan and strategy, and a lot of the countries from the European Space Agency to some of the smaller, newer ones are all interested in lunar things, and not so much the asteroid or the Mars stuff, just because they're not equipped to contribute anything. So obviously they want to get into deep space, they want to come with the United States, or whoever will do it. But if they can't contribute something, then, you know, they're not going to have much of a say, and it's kind of not worth it to them. So I don't really see the Trump administration going away from our partners. If anything, they'll maintain it and try to encourage it, especially their overtures to the Russians. You know, talking to a group of NASA folks a few weeks ago, they didn't seem to think that any of the terrestrial problems had caused a whole lot of issues with the space station, at least. So far, whether or not the RD-180 engine issues or any of the other stuff will resurface remains to be seen, but I don't think that'll be a problem, frankly. I think you might see a little more push toward doing what the international partners want to do, especially with lunar as a means to Mars, not just Mars only. And I know a lot of folks don't like that, but I think, if anything, that might give us more ability to do stuff sooner than later, and I'm just giving an opinion based on what I've seen.
Okay, here's a good one for you from Jim, who is in Pocatello, Idaho. And he says, I'm at work, so I'm not using the telephone. But he says, cyber warfare is a big component of space security. I would at least think so. And it was part, or at least mentioned, in that CNN documentary that you spoke about earlier in today's program. With all the concern and talk, whether real or fanciful, about Russian hacking to influence our election, it appears that we are not doing a very good job in terms of cyber warfare and defending our computer networks, be it they government systems, or be it corporations. My question is, to what degree is this level of cyber warfare, like hacking of the Democrats, if that really happened, by Russia, a space problem versus a terrestrial problem? And what component of space national security should be devoted to cyber defense in space versus some of the more realistic weapon types of programs you talked about earlier, for example, kinetic kill weapons? Should the cyber get a bigger percentage of our budget and our attention, or should the kinetics get the bigger percentage?
That's a good question. I will say cyber is a big deal, especially for the ground infrastructure part, and I think that seems to be getting even more attention from the government than even the space threats. So I haven't done a whole lot of research into the ground segment piece, but the adversaries are doing everything, and we need to find a way to do everything and find a bet with our constrained environment fiscally that we do as much as we can of everything.
Because
you have a cyber capability doesn't mean that they won't shoot as well.
aren't we doing everything back with them cyber-wise? I mean, that's what we hear in the press. Russia can hack our water supply, but we can do the same thing to them so they don't do it.
Well, from what I've heard from cyber guys that I talk to is that things, it's like space. Things are happening a lot. You may not hear about all of them, but we're still trying to figure out how we're going to posture ourselves. There was some C-SPAN hearings that were on that had the commander of Cyber Command on, and he was talking about how, you know, they have to focus strictly on governmental domains because there's just so much infrastructure to defend from a complete total national. So I think what you're seeing, what you'll see is a large investment on cyber. I think with Space Command having one of their numbered air forces being the cyber component of the Air Force, that there is some crosstalk between the space and cyber people to work that. And cyber is one of the many defensive space control problems that are being addressed. So while I think it's, you know, cyber is probably more likely, and the reversible activities is more likely than a kinetic hit, it does not mean that we should just ignore the kinetic. So you probably would try to invest as much as you can to get a balanced approach across all of them to have capability for each possible threat.
Does a cyber attack like hacking the Podesta emails, for example, since that's in the news all the time now, does that go through space resources or is that strictly terrestrial?
From what I understand, the internet and cyber, a lot of government communication transits through satellite. Even with ground infrastructure, ground cabling and things of that sort, there are things that have to be routed and transferred through satellite. So the fact that a person can hack into something, what makes it capable of getting across is satellite aid. It speeds it up. But as I'm not a cyber specialist, I don't really know all the ins and outs and details. I'm aware that a lot of cyber activity routes through space.
Okay, so this is going to lead to this question. John is in Los Angeles, and he says OneWeb just successfully raised $1.2 billion from SoftBank, whatever that is, in Japan, and OneWeb wants to provide free global satellite Wi-Fi services. So because it is satellite-based Wi-Fi, is it more vulnerable to hacking and compromise than if it were a terrestrial ground-based type of internet service?
Well, most of the concerns I've heard about OneWeb has not been so much the Wi-Fi segment of it. It's the fact that it's a lot of small CubeSats that are congesting up low Earth orbit more. And as a result of that, that causes some concerns for, you know, things hitting each other. However, on the Wi-Fi side, the other concern that I have heard issues about is whether or not the frequencies are going to interfere with other operations and or create a dependency for these, you know, people out in the middle of nowhere, Africa or whatever, that don't have internet connectivity right now, that if that were to be lost, that would create other problems that haven't been fully vetted or thought through. So that OneWeb is a great thing. It's a great idea. And it's something that, like White Squared was a few years ago, that kind of creates some concern. And I think that discussion is still ongoing in government circles. I haven't been privy to any of that. I just know what I read since I'm not engaged in the Pentagon right now anymore. So, but from what I have heard from folks and friends and things is that the issue of Wi-Fi can be secured, but there's other things that could cause problems with overlapping comms and congestion of orbital space. We'll see what happens.
As a consumer and, you know, as a concerned citizen, other than writing to members of Congress, do Americans have any option to want to espouse a better strategic defense system or to recommend we stay the course if that's their perspective? Or is a letter to our representative really and truly our only recourse?
I think, frankly, there's a lot of ways people could express their views on this. Writing to your congressman is obviously an easy first step. If your congressman is not so much trained or educated or engaged in space issues like a Representative Bridenstine would be or a Senator Sessions would be, then it may be a little more difficult to get them to see the importance of it. You could take articles like the one I wrote, attach it to them, that provide good summaries of the problem so you don't have to do a lot of research. You can also, if you work for companies or know friends who work for space companies, that, you know, a lot of commercial companies are doing their best to try to find solutions for these things too. It's not just the government thinking about these things. So writing letters to, you know, space committee heads, writing a letter to the incoming presidential administration. I know the websites for the Trump transition team, I think, still has this up. They had a tell us what you think kind of a section where you could put in issues of concern to you, and this could be one of those things to get them aware of that as one of the interests. And then, of course, advocacy organizations that typically advocate more for the long-term vision of space settlement and development and things. Could also use this as a stepping stone to their objectives as well, because you want to have a secure environment in order to make money and to send folks out and to colonize and develop. So, and I'm all for that, and I think the incoming, a lot of the incoming guys who are on the transition team, like Charles Miller, definitely are for that too. So that's what I would suggest.
Jane is in St. Louis and says, I have in the past worked for what David referred to a little while ago as a legacy aerospace company. It's one thing to rely on the government to protect our systems for us. It's another thing for the company to be as proactive as possible to have robust systems to protect itself. I found that working for the company, while this was not my department, that what we were doing and the budget we were applying for taking care of matters ourselves rather than relying on the government kept substantially increasing each year, and the technical people we have on board were absolutely the equal of anyone working for the government. For the most part, we didn't rely on the government, but we welcomed their support. We felt it was our responsibility to be able to protect our own systems. So, again, we were in a defensive posture because, obviously, we can't do anything offensive. But there was a heck of a lot that was done for defense over the years that I worked with the company. And I'm just wondering if, in your perspective, other companies are taking a similar approach, or do they sit back and wait for the government to do it for them?
Yeah, great point. I'm glad you brought that up. One of my favorite parts of my job that I had was working with industry, including new companies and legacy companies, as they're called, I guess. I can tell you from just, even you guys can see this for yourself too by reading op-eds and things, but there are not very many companies these days that are not engaged in defending and creating a sustainable system for their customers, whether it be a government contract or whether it be a commercial contract. They want to provide a service that will be sustainable and long-lasting and reliable, and that reliability also implies that if there is a government-hosted payload on board that can make it a target, they want to make their vehicles as resilient, if I may use that term, as possible. So you'll see, I've seen commentaries about this. I've seen organized events in D.C. and around the country where big CEOs of groups like Intelsat and Inmarsat, SES and other, Boeing and Xtar have all been talking about ways in which they're working to make sure that their stuff is done and done well. And that helps a great deal. I also mentioned, I think, earlier with regard to space traffic management, the ability to track what's going on up there and to keep everybody's things from colliding is something that the industry has kind of taken up a big chunk of. And that CNN report showed AGI ComSpoc is one of the things that SDA is using, Satellite Data Association is using to supplement and complement the JSPOC. So I think the industry is doing a pretty good job of this, and they're leaning forward. in some ways more than the government is, because they don't have to necessarily coordinate among multiple departments. They just have their own company. And in some cases, there are trade associations that have space councils that are also making discussions about ways to have standards to protect and take care of their own. So I think the industry is doing a good job on that.
We're coming up close to the end of the program. What do you look forward to, or what would you like to think that we should be focusing on as the Trump administration gets going? What would be key indicators for those of us that want to follow this field? What should we keep our eyes on?
I would watch for who becomes the policy leadership for both this new Space Council, if it indeed gets, you know, created, or the National Security Council side and that administrator. Because, frankly, and actually one other big position you want to watch is the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. That office really has more clout policy-wise than the NASA administrator does in government. The NASA administrator is not as big of a influencer as it used to be under the 1960s with the James Webb era. Since the 70s, 80s going forward, pretty much whatever the national space policy is comes out of OSTP. And NASA has the representatives in the process, but OSTP pretty much runs that. So National Space Council that's created will have that. So I'd watch who becomes OSTP director, who becomes the space piece of OSTP director, and who becomes NASA administrator. And the other big thing to watch is who becomes the chairman or retains chairmanships of key committees. I personally think that while Jim Bridenstine is a very big supporter of new space and space in general, I don't think it would be wise to continue to pull from Congress and the Senate for your administration leads, because you need to have, the Trump administration will need to have folks that can do things and be supportive. So I would watch those things.
He doesn't seem to be listening to you because he likes to pull from Congress, doesn't he?
Well, a lot of people do that because they've already had government experience, and it's easy to network when you know people.
Right. I understand why, but that does leave those positions vulnerable that knew something about it unless they inherit the same staff.
Right. I really think that, and a lot of guys don't do that. A lot of guys want their own people, because each staff is shaped for the member of Congress or the administrator that they have. And they're all, a lot of them are appointed positions, especially on the administration side. So it'll be interesting to see what mix, and I'm sure you will see a mix of people from both new space commercial and legacy government experiences on the team to provide perspective so that they are well thought through. Well, at least that's the trends I'm seeing at this point.
What should we have talked about today that we have not done so yet, or overlooked, or forgotten, or didn't even know to bring up?
I think we covered most of the big issues that I was aware of. If there's any other questions you have, I'm more than willing to entertain that. And if anybody also has questions and they want to post it on the blog, feel free, or you can give them my blog site and have them make a comment and that they're looking for me, and I can do my best to answer this.
Why don't you put your blog site address out for listeners right now?
Sure. I don't blog every day, but I comment on a various variety of things. It's realspacestrategy.wordpress.com. And if you Google search it, you can also find it under Real Space Strategy and Christopher Stone.
I'm curious, do any other branches of the service, including outreach and, say, the Coast Guard, do they have a big role in space defense, or is it mostly all on the shoulders of the Air Force?
The Air Force is the predominant lead of DOD space. In fact, the Secretary of the Air Force is now known as the Principal DOD Space Advisor. Other services like the Army.
Wait a minute. So the woman, and I forget her name, or I would say her name, who is the Secretary of the Air Force right now, is the head person for Air Force DOD space security? She's the Secretary of the Air Force.
She is the principal DOD space advisor, and she also...
what does she know about that? I mean...
She has a staff that creates the information she needs for those decisions. She has what's called the PDSA staff.
But when you get selected to be the Secretary of the Air Force of the Navy or whatever, do they look for this person to have expertise in these fields, or do they just say they can go build a staff for it and they'll be okay?
Depends. There have been folks who are obviously more prepared than others when they're appointed. She, I believe, had some experience previously in government as well as working for SAIC, which is a company that does a lot of contract consulting work for the defense and aerospace world.
Is that a big part of being appointed to Secretary of the Air Force, is that you know something about Air Force space security?
I would think it should be. I'm not sure what the vetting process was thinking when they brought her or her predecessors in. I just know that a lot of the defense news and other press people were saying, oh, yeah, she's got a lot of great experience in the aerospace field. But the staff that I was on, we would provide briefings to her to get her up to speed on some issues that she might not be aware of regarding space, so that when she goes into the forums, she's prepared. Obviously, with different agendas of higher-ups in the National Security Council, not everything that a secretary even wants may get through. But Secretary Deborah Lee James is her name. She's been a pretty big advocate for the space piece. The Army has some Army support. The Navy used to do some space things, but they're more into the network warfare thing. Coast Guard, not so sure about that, but pretty much every service utilizes space assets.
Are the Marines represented separately from the Navy, or are they part of the Navy on that?
Usually at Defense Space Council meetings, if I remember correctly, they were represented by Navy folks. I think sometimes there will be Marine Corps. At the Joint Chiefs of Staff level, if there's a discussion on a space issue, the Marines have their own seat at the table.
So the Navy is not as active in this, and they're going down a different road? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they used to have a space command of their own, and now they don't have a space command. They have a small space policy shop, and they have some folks who operate in different space efforts and programs, but because they need them for their fleet. They have special fleet satellite communications programs that they're big into, like NUOS and stuff.
Right.
So each service has a piece, but the Air Force is kind of the big space provider for the DOD, at least, and they have been for quite a while.
Are any foreign but ally militaries part of that DOD consulting group, like the UK or any of our allies? Do they sit at the table, or is it strictly only for U.S. perspective?
Usually when there's international engagement, it's done in separate forums. So the Defense Space Council is strictly a Defense Department entity. Although if a topic requires somebody from NASA or somebody to come in and be a part of the discussion, they can invite those folks. But when it comes to the interagency discussions, those are usually held at higher levels, such as the what's called IPCs, the Intermediate Policy Committee, or the deputies and principals. So those are like the secretaries and deputy secretaries can come together and have meetings, and of course the full cabinet meets at the NSC level if it's a security issue. And if the Space Council comes into fruition, there'll be a similar type of construct most likely and that will have all entities and departments that touch space, like Department of State, Commerce, Trade Representative, things of that sort. So it's not just a military issue. Usually they always bring in other departments of government.
Now, Trump gets to appoint his own secretaries of the military services, right?
Correct.
And he's relying on space and national security space from his advisors and his transition team, because I guess based on his campaign comments and stuff like that, this is not an area of his expertise.
Well, it wasn't something that was, you know, at the top of everyone's list nationwide, but they started talking about it. So, yeah, usually what a landing team does, as I understand it, is they get a bunch of folks with different backgrounds that go into each agency and department and do an assessment of the current condition of things, whether it be policy, budgets, things of that sort. And then they come back to the transition team bigwigs and say, here's what we found. Here's what our recommendations are for you as the president. And here's who we suggest to fix the problem or change the policy direction or continue as is, you know, with status quo if that's the case. So that's what those guys are for. And that's why I think you see a combination of new space guys like Miller, some older NASA hands and military guys like Rod and that's Chris Schenck guy. So I think that's what you'll see.
You do have one final question that came in from George, who's in Miami, Florida. And he says, can you speculate on NASA administrator?
Well, I've been thinking about that. And I've heard a lot of good names. Some that I like more than others, some that I know and I've worked with, and others I've only seen or dealt with from a distance. So, of course, I mentioned Bridenstine. Yeah, he might be a great guy, but if you lose all your passionate advocates in Congress, you're not going to get anything funded. And if you don't get anything funded, as the advertisement for Mr. Whitmer, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. So that would be kind of detrimental, I think. I've seen Doug Cook's name brought up, and he was, of course, Marshall Space Flight Center, I think, director for a while, and he works for a company there in Huntsville. That's great and all. I would think that a lot of other NASA centers and a lot of congressional delegations that are related to those NASA centers might have a little bit of concern if he were to be the appointee because of his so heavy career being so much into Marshall, that a lot of people might think that, you know, he may heavily favor Marshall over other centers, blah, blah, blah. So usually NASA administrators are pulled from groups that are a little more outside of the NASA family or have been at NASA headquarters long enough to show that they're broader than one center. Scott Pace, obviously, his name has been brought up a lot. I know he would probably be a good guy. But we shall see. I mean, he may pull out somebody that we've not even thought of and that the speculators in the press haven't even thought of. Kind of like he did with his Secretary of State. So we shall see where that goes.
Absolutely. Probably won't know until after a while. I think Obama didn't name Bolden until June or July or August.
Right.
After he was sworn in. I mean, it took a long time to identify someone for NASA.
Right. They've got 6,000 some odd political appointment positions to fill. And from what I've been reading and hearing from folks that I worked with, that their goal is to try to get as many of those filled as they can, as soon as they can. They don't want to drag it out. They want a functioning government as soon as possible.
So are you up for anything?
No. I doubt it. I don't think I have any of the connections or the clout for any of that. You know, it would be fun, but I don't expect anything.
So you would go and move to the swamp to do it then, right?
I mean, I lived there for 7.5 years, so I would not mind living in the area. Not so much in D.C. proper, but I'm not really an urban guy, but I would not mind helping out. If I was given a chance to help out, I wouldn't mind.
Well, let's check back with you later in 2017, and we'll see if you can give us a report card, a first semester or second semester report card on what's happening with national security space and the new administration.
Okay, sounds good to me.
So that would be fun. I don't know if first quarter will be enough time to know anything, but maybe by second quarter you'd be able to give us a first report card on what you think is happening with the guys.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be willing to help out with that.
Okay. Again, a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you. Thank you for being on the program today. And listeners, also the same to you again. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And remember, our next show is Tuesday night, and it is open lines. Tom Olson comes back on for his annual overall review of Space 2016, and that is a week from today. And then we return with a really cool show, and you'll just have to read about it in the newsletter. On, I believe it's going to be Tuesday, January 3rd, because there's no show on, or January 2nd, whatever Tuesday is. is when we return, because I think New Year's, January 1st is a Sunday, right?
Right.
I think so. Okay, that's our schedule, everybody. It'll be posted on our website. Have good holidays. Keep it safe, and keep looking up, everybody. You might see a rocket-powered Santa this year. Goodbye from the Space Show, and from Chris Stone, and from me, David.